Welcome, friends. James Corbett here from CorbettReport.com. It is the 5th of March, 2012, and today we are joined on the line once again for our weekly conversation with Bob Chapman, a.k.a. the International Forecaster of TheInternationalForecaster.com. Bob Chapman, thank you so much for joining us bright and early this Monday morning.
Well, you're very welcome. It's nice to be here again. And the world is still a very exciting place.
It doesn't seem to be getting boring at any rate, which could be a good thing or could be a bad thing, but at any rate, it's a thing, so let's make the most of it. And as we sit here on this Monday morning, lots of news making headlines all around the world. Actually, I wanted to start off with Russian president-to-be Vladimir Putin once again getting re-elected, re-coronated, one might say. And I guess this is exactly what was expected. I mean, this is not a shock at all, so I don't imagine there will be any real effect in the markets in the near term. But what do you think are the long-term ramifications of Putin being reelected?
Well, I don't know the insides of the Russian government and all the players. In fact, I don't even know how Putin really fits in with all of it. And he obviously is part of some clique. We don't know whether that clique is controlled by outsiders such as the Illuminati. Russia is still a very, very difficult place to access, especially their thought processes and where they're coming from. But I think that the performance by Putin in the past has been excellent. I mean, all this fault around about him running around with his shirt off and, you know, looking like Tarzan in his 60s. That's okay. Who cares? I mean, what's happening in Russia? It's pretty good. And they cleaned up a lot of the crime and they threw all the oligarchs out, which is the Rothschilds and all their buddies who went in to try to steal the whole country. And that hasn't quite reached its end yet, but it will in time. And so I think that Russia's doing quite well. The reports I get, people are very happy to be living there now. There's no wars, which is just terrific. There's no militarized government. And they continue to build and protect themselves and try to get manufacturing going so that they can compete with Western Europe, Germany in particular. So I'm glad to see him there. He's a strong force. He's not a meatball. He's brilliant. He looks to be in excellent physical condition running around like that. And good luck to him. And good luck to the Russian people. They've been through enough crap over the last 100 years. I mean, nobody needs what they've had.
Well, that cannot be disputed. But let me play devil's advocate for a moment, because I certainly understand what you're saying in terms of Putin being the strong leader who has resisted a lot of NATO's influence and all of the evils that go along with that. But on the other hand, Putin came to power on the crest of a hysteria over some bombings that were taking place in Moscow and around Russia at the time, back in the 90s, that actually later it traced back to his buddies in the FSB, because, of course, he was an old KGB crony, and since then, I mean, a lot of things have come out about Putin and his desire to recreate the USSR and all but name in various forms. For example, back in October of 2011, he was talking about his dream of a Eurasian Union and other such things. And I wonder if we can be pulled into the phony dialectic in terms of seeing someone resisting the NATO and all of the evils that go along with that, and thinking, well, then they must be on the good side, when in fact they just represent the evil of another side, if they're not even puppeteered by the same people, as you alluded to earlier. So I wonder if we can be suckered into going along with an evil just because it's resisting another evil.
I think that what I said at the very beginning was we really don't know what's going on inside Russia. And I think today that even the CIA has a hard time, much harder time than I had when I was involved in counterintelligence. And so, I, you know, it's a coin flip. I mean, we don't know. And so we weighed both sides of it here. And maybe he's a little arsonist. You know, some of the things you've got to look at here, importantly, is the success of the government and the economy itself. Now, needless to say, if they didn't have oil and gas, they'd be in tough shape. But they do have it. And I think they're going to continue to do well. If I was the United States, I certainly would not get in a war in Iran, because the Russians would certainly be in it, and maybe the Chinese as well, in all likelihood. It would bring on a third world war, and the loss of life would be incredible, probably half or more of people on the planet. And who knows how many would die a week or a year or 10 years or 20 years later from the fallout of all these nuclear weapons. And so Russia has probably, if not the best, close to being the best military equipment in the world. If I would say, person who is in the American military, I'd be very, very concerned. Because you're dealing with people who are intelligent, and they have a long culture, and they have the implements to defend themselves. And, you know, I can't think, and of course there's always a few, but I can't think of people who are FSB or ex-KGB as being cronies. I mean, this was the cream of Russian society, with the exception of the scientists and those who went into universities. And, you know, even the military at the top, you know, indirectly takes orders from these people because they're counterintelligence capabilities were and are enormous. And I'm very familiar with that. That's how wars are won. Intelligence. And then you got to occupy, and then it's logistics. And I said several months ago, when they were running around on all these ships and everybody was going to blow up the Strait of Hormuz and all of this stuff. And I said, no, that's not going to happen, because the U.S. isn't ready yet. So even if they wanted to, they can't, until I get certain things in place. And I went into detail. But I look at Russia as a neutral with their own interests. They want to be active in Asia and maybe have close relationships with them, because they want to sell to them. They did that in the European Union and the Eurozone. So, you got to look at all these things from both sides. But I think the bottom line is we just don't know.
Well, as you say, we will certainly have to wait to see how things start to play out under the renewed Putin leadership. But switching gears slightly, why don't we move into some of the other news that's making headlines right now? And I know that you always have your eye on the markets in terms of gold and silver and how they're moving. Perhaps you can give us an update on that.
Well, it's early Monday morning here in the Western Hemisphere. I don't see the gold and silver suppression cartel at work. I think they're absent. And we've seen gold off early on about $10 or so. And now it's off about 5 or 6. And it probably will come back to even on its own if it starts to rally. More than $10, I would think that suppression cartel would step into the market. And the reason why is the situation in Europe is still totally upside down. Are these holders of debt of Greece going to accept a 70% haircut? They've already been told that the insurance that they bought is worthless because the people who sold it to them told them they could take a hike on collecting. It just shows you how criminal this whole thing is. And so they've either got to write the whole thing off, or these are mostly hedge funds, or accept 30%. Now, they're mercenaries, so they'll probably accept the 30%, but nobody knows that. And then you have the interim funding coming up of the short-term debt, the two-year debt of Greece. And then you have to have approval by the European nations in March of fulfilling the previous pledges of bailout monies. And then there's the discussion of an additional firewall, taking them up to about $1 trillion in the EFSF and the ESM, which are two funds dispersing organizations, to be used to fund and help the debtors in the countries that are in trouble. Then on top of that, in April early, which is now only a month from now, you have a Greek election. And if the new Democratic Party wins, Mr. Samaras, and I say, no, we're not going to abide by that. It was rammed through by a guy who wasn't even president. Yeah, give me a break. He wasn't elected. So it's all null and void. So we're back to square one again. So that's why they keep on leaning on gold and silver, at least at this moment. That, to me, is the main reason.
And on top of that, I mean, if all of that wasn't enough, as you note in the most recent edition of The Forecaster, Ireland is also banging at the EU's front door, but no one is listening. You say they want the EU to restructure a promissory note for $41 billion. The debt is a result of the bailout of the Anglo-Irish Bank owned by Europe's Royal Illuminists. And also talking about Mario Draghi and the ECB and some of the outrageous things that they're doing and lying about. I mean, it's like a horrible opera gone very wrong at in Europe right now. And it's, it just seems that the fat lady isn't going to sing anytime soon.
No. When I was a little boy, I found that if you told a lie, you had to tell 20 or 30 of them to cover it up. And I felt like that was too much work, and it wasn't worth it. So I'd never been a liar. And so these people in Europe are being hoisted in their own petard. They say these lies, and then they got to keep on making up more lies to cover up for them. You would think a man of such intelligence would be, you know, have more sense than that. Because sooner or later, it's going to take them down. And so this is going to be ongoing. And when they run out of that money, that 1.46, 1.4 in round figures, $1 trillion, there was a gift of the American taxpayer via the Federal Reserve. They'll run out of that in a year, year and a half. That'll be the end of it. Now they have another one and another one. And the only thing that'll stop all that is inflation, 30%, maybe more. And that's why, and here's a little secret that nobody else is talking about. 98% of the funds dispersed in the United States, England, and Europe have been to the financial sector by governments. Now, why are they not contributing to the economies? Helping. Recovery. Recovery means inflation. It means monetization. And they don't want that. So there isn't going to be any recovery. But sooner or later, one or the other will overwhelm. And it's very dangerous taking inflation to a lower level when it can get out of hand. And then all of a sudden, you find out you get deflation, you can't control it. So they're walking a very fine line, these central banks. And they'll make a mess of it.
Well, isn't that
too many factors?
Absolutely. I mean, isn't that always the way? And of course, the question is, I mean, is there any way out of it? And as you open the most recent issue of the Forecaster, you basically say that no, there really isn't. You say that there are those who believe that Greece's problems are but a precursor to what much of the world will eventually experience, and we believe such predictions are correct and cannot be avoided. So it looks like it's time for people to buckle up and button down for what you say is pretty much inevitable at this point.
Yeah, but be patient. And I know that only comes to old people. But you got to be patient. These sensationalistic cries for default and particularly devaluation of the U.S. dollar and other currencies, it's going to come when it comes. As Hegel said, stop making up stories and stop trying to pick dates. It's impossible. And all you're doing is confusing people. And many of the letter writers are doing that. And, you know, I see one group, one day they get three or four very pro-gold and silver articles out of their group of writers, and the next day they get four saying gold and silver is not going to work very well. And then they defy the fact that there's manipulation. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. Only because it's politically acceptable, or only because they're working for the U.S. government. Interesting, huh?
Well, interesting is one word for it, but here's one thing that I can't really wrap my head around, and maybe that's just because of the place that I'm coming from, but when I mean, I understand that when newsletter writers or article writers or media people or whoever make bold predictions about the end of the world next week or whatever, of course they get a lot of attention from that, and they can get new subscribers or whatever they're trying to go for from a monetary perspective, but when that fails to come, why do people continue going back to those sources that have cried that the sky is falling so many times? What is it about the psyche of people who are attracted to people who are constantly coming out with those sensationalistic predictions that consistently fail to come true?
Oh, that they're consistently wrong, like the Chartists and the Wavis and the other people of that venue. I mean, it's cost people a fortune being wrong all the time because you can't use technical analysis in markets that are all rigged. I mean, it isn't any more difficult than that to recognize. But of course, you have within that structure people who want to be accepted among their peers as being one of the grand poobahs. And then you have the financial aspects as well. One of the things that's good about my launch over the last 23 years into this is that I don't need money. I don't have an ego. I don't care what people think. I never have, actually. I set a course, and I think if it's the right one, that's great. And if I have to change, sometimes I have to change. There are forces out there today that make it almost impossible to make predictions. All you can do is generalize the direction, the trend. And that's even on of itself is difficult. So when I see a group come out with 10 articles, 5 going one way and 5 going the other, this is disinformation. There's a reason for this. And then all of a sudden, in the last number of years, you have these so-called experts, most of whom have no training whatsoever to make an expert. I mean, I can count on one hand all of the so-called experts who have ever done anything professionally, with the exception of universities and professors. But I mean, talking about people who have been in the wars at the front, and commodities and stocks. I mean, you don't know what it's like until you've been there and managed hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. I mean, it's easy for a writer to say, well, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. And he's 34 years old, went to university, maybe even majored in business and finance. He still doesn't know what's going on. And so there's not enough people who have done enough of their homework. And it's disappointing. And I shout out, if you're out there and you want to do it, please, I'll help you so I don't have to do this anymore.
Well, that's an really important point, isn't it? Because there's so many aspects to what makes someone who can actually put together a coherent analysis of a situation. And it obviously involves a number of factors, from the real life experience of doing it professionally to the ability to analyze and to adapt and to mold something that will actually hang together. And it's rather difficult for all of those factors to come into play in a way that actually makes sense. And it happens fairly rarely, I would say. So it's always good when we do find those sources of information that are reliable. But obviously, I mean, they're few and far between in any age. So I wouldn't say that we're particularly, unlucky to be living in this age or any other. But let's think about some of the titans that have come before us and that have preceded myself and others that have influenced our work, whether we know it or not. And you yourself are one of those people, and you've been involved with a lot of the others who were also, holding this light up in the past and lighting the way for those in the future. So let me just read a little bit quotation to you that you may be familiar with. It says, "Most of us have had the experience, either as parents or youngsters, of trying to discover the hidden picture within another picture in a children's magazine. Usually you are shown a landscape with trees, bushes, flowers, and other bits of nature. The caption reads something like this: concealed somewhere in this picture is a donkey pulling a cart with a boy in it. Can you find them? Try as you might, usually you could not find the hidden picture until you turned to a page further back in the magazine, which would reveal how cleverly the artist had hidden it from us. If we study the landscape, we realize that the whole picture was painted in such a way as to conceal the real picture within. And once we see the real picture, it stands out like the proverbial painful digit." And those, I'm hoping some of the listeners will be familiar with that. Those are some of the opening lines of None Dare Call It Conspiracy, published in 1971 by Gary Allen. And absolutely one of the touchstone landmark works of literature in this regard that have really paved the way for a lot of people. And it's refreshing to be rereading this right now and to see so much of this information has now filtered down to a much wider audience than it must have been 40 plus years ago when this was originally penned. And now we know about, or lots of people know about the secret meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910, or know about how the Rothschilds financed all of the major European wars in the 18th and 19th century, etc., etc. But at the time, I mean, this was some pretty revolutionary stuff, and people like Gary Allen and yourself and G. Edward Griffin were there already mining this material and really exposing it to people who had never heard of it before. So I was interested to hear about your own experiences with people like Gary and G. Edward Griffin and Norm Dodd and others who have been there before and who really have had the experience of seeing this and putting it together from whole cloth, from not having the people before them to really show them about it, like we have the great good fortune to be living in today with the internet having all of these resources at our fingertips.
I never knew Norman Dodd, but I know Stan Monteith. And Stan Monteith was there at the beginning as well. People overlook him, and he's still on radio. I do two shows with him every week. And he's a wonderful, wonderful man. The catalyst of all of these people getting together was the John Birch Society. And I went to a Birch meeting in 1963, and it was in the fall of that year, and it was at the lady's home. And That's when Gary and I met, and we became fast acquaintances. I met G.W. Griffith probably about 6 months or a year later at some kind of a meeting, I can't remember where, and we got along very well as well. So we got to be pretty good friends. Alan Stang came on a little bit later, at least in my life, which was the mid to late 1960s, and is a guy that nobody ever talks about. And he's been more in, he was not a member of the Birch Society. He's been more in the creation of records, the original Illuminati records, recordings, I should call them nowadays. And a very famous actor did the voice. And Tony told me one time, he said, the only reason I got him to do it is he was broke. And Carradine did it. And he had that low, booming, mysterious, theatrical voice. Anyway, Tony did a lot of films and posters, and we did a lot of things together. And in January of this year, he just came out with another one, which I'm running in the next issue, incidentally. I've run it once before. But don't leave Tony out. Most of the people don't know who he is, but he's been very instrumental. And he would kind of work parallel along with the ideas of the other fellows involved. There were no standing women involved that I can remember, although a lot of them did a lot of wonderful work in bringing to the attention the things that Gary later brought out in 1971. I helped him develop the publication, None Day Call It Conspiracy, more from a financial view than anything else. One of his writers, one of the people who work with him, I can't remember his name, and I'm sorry, but you get old, you forget. But anyway, he turned out later, turning out left-wing propaganda. I was shocked. And this is within the last 5 years. So, you know, he's about probably my age, so he's got to be in the 70s. So maybe that's where his heart was in the first place, or maybe he changed. I think his name was Sam. I don't remember his last name. But be as it may, that's how Conspiracy came about, and we had garages full of them, the books. I mean, we were selling in 10 or 15 for the dollar. We printed so many of them. And they went all over the world. I have people who contact me and say, gee, I have a copy. My father passed it down, and Gary signed it, or you signed it, or something like that. But anyway, my association with those people was rather loose for a number of years. I was a stockbroker, specializing in gold and silver shares, and Ed was doing his films, writing, and we started to come full circle again in the late 1970s. And we started the Gary Allen Report. Gary had a report before that with another person who is now deceased, Larry Abraham. And he came to me, he said, I want to do a publication, but I can't do it with Larry anymore because he's an evil genius. I said, really? And, you know, this is a straight skinny. I don't make this stuff up. So I says, look, you want it? I'll help you. So I funded the thing, put it all together. We got some professionals to tell the world about the publication, and it was either 30 or 40, I think it was 40,000 subscribers we had. And I wrote the financial part, and Gary wrote the political part, and it went along quite nicely until 1985-86, Gary had diabetes, undiagnosed, and they started to have to chop his legs off, and you know where that ends up. And so poor Gary died, this big, strapping, 6'3", played football for Stanford. A guy dies a miserable death. And I guess there's no nice ways to die. But anyway, and Gary left us. And Ed started putting together the creature from Jekyll Island, which has really usurped the place of all the other books. Because there were good books written before that, Lightning Over the Treasury Building. I forget who wrote that. And then there was The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by, and he was a very good friend of mine. Knew him for years and years. Well, the same time I met them, Eustace Mullins. And, but the book, for whatever reason, has educated hundreds of millions of people throughout the world to the banking conspiracy, something that pamphlets we certainly couldn't sell in the 1960s and 70s. And, of course, everything changed with the introduction of the Internet late in the 1980s. And, of course, talk radio started to crank up about that time. And that evolutionary process has been able to bring the works and the good deeds of these people to the public. The truth. It's all we're talking about here. There's nothing mystical about this. All of the people involved had read the history of business and finance and economics going back at least for 10 centuries. They knew all who was behind all this. They knew there was an Illuminati and still is today. But a lot of people don't want to recognize that. Well, that's their shortcoming. But we nailed it. And we brought it to the attention of the public. And the Birch Society was very instrumental in that. And you had the freedom you have today because of the work that was done during those years. Because the timetable of the Illuminists has been put off twice. The first one was 1970 and then again in 2012. It's not happening. And now they're running with us breathing down their collars because we are winning the info war. And that's where control is. And so the work that these early people did, and there were others, many of them who are now deceased, Justin Knapp and the woman who wrote Dear and Glorious Physician and so many other wonderful books, Taylor Caldwell. I mean, there were some giants during those days, but it was so hard to get the word out. I mean, today on this broadcast, all over the world, eventually there may be 10 or 50 million people that will hear what we're talking about. That wasn't possible in those days.
Certainly not, but absolutely. I mean, it speaks to the passion that the people had back then to not only, I guess, get the word out about it, but to even educate themselves. I mean, it must have been a much, much more difficult process of finding and uncovering and exposing this information back before this age of the internet that we're all spoiled by today. And it's interesting to hear you talk about some of these people, especially some of the lesser known ones, because obviously J. Edward Griffin and yourself and Stan Monteith and various others are still out there still working and still have some media presence. But for those who were toiling in that sort of pre-video, pre-talk radio era, that it's almost like a lot of their work has gone lost to the ether. So the Gary Allens and others who are not so well known, unfortunately, maybe their legacy might not be seen as and heard as much as it should be.
Well, I think the archives of the Birch Society or a place where you can go and get some of these articles written through the years. They were brilliant. We fired a hole in the side of their ship, and they couldn't keep the water out. And still to this day, they can't. They're skating on thin ice, and they know it. Because we now have told the public, and not the whole public, I mean, in the entire world, maybe 5%. That's still a lot of people. And we've told them what's being done to them. We've told them that the key to power for the Illuminists, the elitists, whatever you want to call them, Stan calls them the Brotherhood of Darkness. These people exist. They have these organizations that go back centuries. They've been doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And you'd have to be a dimwit if exposed to it, not to understand it. I mean, I look at television and I see all of these venerable people from Wall Street, extraordinarily bright, extraordinarily mercenary. I know, I worked there for a long time. But I would say probably half of them know what's going on and the other half don't want to know. And they go along and play their game and hope in the end that everything works out. It's been that way because this group of people have been running things for so long that it probably won't change. It will change. The public of the world have discovered a great discovery. Who runs the world and how they get away with it.
Of course, with all the great discoveries, the question is, what do you do with that knowledge? And that's the question, the $64 quadrillion question that's being asked right now, and quite writ large in many ways. But absolutely interesting to hear about some of those earlier days. And I think you raise an interesting point, because it almost seems as strange as it, counterintuitive as it might be in this age where we have all of this information at our fingertips. It almost seems like in past generations, in past centuries, people might have been more aware of that overt influence and control over their lives, because people just had to look to the big castle on the hill to know who was ruling over them. But these days, the real rulers really hang back. I mean, so far behind the scenes, and we probably don't even know a lot of the names of some of the richest people on the planet, simply because they like to keep themselves behind the scenes. So, and unfortunately, with the sophistication of the propaganda now, it seems like people in many ways can be led into the sleepwalking through their lives more easily than at any other time in history.
The difference now is the prosperity that was laid open to the world, particularly in the United States of America, after the Second World War. That's all deliberately changing. It was done through free trade, globalization, offshoring, and outsourcing. The mass exodus and sale and movement of corporations out of America, 450,000 of them, along with the 12 million jobs that were lost over 12 years. So with that said, what we're looking at here is the deliberate destruction of an economy, and along with Europe and England. And the people behind and that control those countries, they're not going to lose their power. They just move their base of financing and money-making operations to China or someplace else. They plan all these things. They don't happen. They're in the works for 20, 30, 40 years. And, you know, I wrote about this subject in 1967 in American Mercury. And no, nobody would listen. You're crazy. It'd be impossible to do that. They can't do that. They wouldn't want to do that. Brother, they did it. 22.5% unemployment? And it's not improving any. And it's not going to. Because if you have a recovery, what happens is you then have inflation. And if you have inflation, they can't continue their game, because if inflation goes to 30, 40, 50%, you have hyperinflation and everything blows up financially. And so this is the game that we're into right now, and this is why the sensationalization of things that are happening or facts are very, very important. And people who have a responsibility to the public should not be coming up with idiotic ideas or self-helping ideas that'll make them more money. I find it grievous. There has to be a balance, and many of these people don't have it. A balance in looking at things. And so, you know, let's all work together and not for your personal wealth accumulation.
Well, that's exactly right, and I have faith that the public will, you know, eventually be able to sort out which is which. I mean, you can be fooled by some hucksters for so long, but at a certain point, if they don't deliver the goods, so to speak, they won't survive. Which is really, again, what it's about. It's about the free flow of ideas and free market, and the market will decide, like in so many other things. But you're right. I mean, it is bizarre to think of the some of the sensationalism and other silliness that goes on, especially when you don't really need to sensationalize the news. I mean, the headlines are just out of this planet, and that's from the quote unquote straight press, the mainstream press, whatever you want to call them. The NDAA, of course, we saw earlier this year. Now we see the illegalization of protest, quote unquote, at any event that will be attended by a Secret Service, and all of these other just crazy moves, just overt tyranny by the government. You don't really need to make up headlines in order to draw people's attention. I think just reporting what's actually going on is enough. I think for what's really out there.
Just the truth. Or as Sergeant Friday used to say, just the facts, ma'am.
Exactly right.
I imagine a few of you remember that television series.
Even I do, although it did predate my time, but certainly I do remember that. All right, well, I've been monopolizing your time, but finally tonight, Bob, anything that's on your radar that you'd like to get to on this Monday?
Yeah, keep your eye on Europe. There's going to be some big surprises. The German people and others are fed up with the Germans spend $300 billion a year subsidizing and supporting the other six who are on their fannies financially. And they're just not going to continue to do it. And so they're having second thoughts about socialism. And one of the very, very interesting things here, if you look, mainstream media and even the alternative media, you seldom see an attack on socialism, which is really the genesis, really the core of what this problem's all about. Socialism, fascism, Marxism, Leninism, none of them work. But they're created to conflict with one another, to create a power center for the people behind the scenes. And that's what this is all about. And it takes you a lifetime to figure that out. It's not easy.
Well, certainly not. But on that note, I mean, it springs to mind the fact that other isms are being created, are always being forged and thrown out to try to distract the public. And I see that so many times with so many of the different things that are being presented to us as possible, quote unquote, solutions to our problems. When I'm more and more convinced as time passes that the real only solutions will ever come when we stop looking for solutions from outside ourselves and actually start taking power into our own hands to take control of our own lives. But what's your take on that, Bob?
Well, historically, that's been done by sovereign nations. And the amalgamation of Europe is a good example of how not to do those things. It was an unnatural act. It will collapse. It will be the end of the elitist effort to create world government. They just screwed the whole thing up. I mean, this is something that we had an effect on. But boy, they made a mess out of it. And I wrote about it in the early 90s. I said, look, one interest rate can't fit all. None of these people have anything in common. I mean, in one country, you get five different dialects of the same language. Why? Because they're all tribes. But nobody calls them that anymore. Tribes only come from Africa and Southeast Asia. No, they're tribes. Yeah, ask any anthropologist. He knows what I'm talking about. And so it couldn't work. But these dingbats went ahead with it anyway, because they could use it. And then we had our Cold War, which was part of it. What a terrible waste of time. You know, me chasing Russians all over the place and they chasing me all over the place. For what? It was a scam. And all those poor souls who served in all those wars since World War I, they were created for profit, for the military-industrial complex, to control people, to reduce world population. They got to do it over and over again until you stop them. And we will stop them.
We certainly will. And on that note, I think this might be a good time to introduce people to the International Forecaster, which I think is going to be one of those tools that people can use to inform themselves and better prepare themselves for what's coming, and also to arm themselves for what's coming intellectually.
Well, we certainly hope so. A lot of time and effort has gone into that. And the last thing, when I retired as a stockbroker 23 or 24 years ago, when I was 52 years old, I never dreamed I would be a writer. Oh, I had written, but nothing like this. I would have never dreamed I'd be on radio continuously for 25 years. And, you know, you never know what's God's work for you in this world. And I think that's what turned out to be mine. Anyway, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, social and political reasons all over the world. And we publish by email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, usually runs around 35 or 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy for those who are not on the internet. And everything that you need to know each week is in that publication, right up to date. If you'd like a free introductory copy, go to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, F-O-R-E-C-A-S-T-E-R.com, or to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who want to ask a question, we answer everyone. Want a copy of the publication or would like a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, email us. That address is bobbob@intforecaster.com, bob@intforecaster.com. And for those of you who like to call toll free, that number is 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. You can get copies there, and they also have a special there. And if you'd like to get a free one-year subscription, go to that number, and the offering that they're making, I think, is terrific, and you should take advantage of it.
Bob Chapman, the International Forecaster, intforecaster.com. Always a pleasure talking with you. I'm looking forward to next week.
Well, thank you very much. And I would like to thank everybody for listening. And I'm off to another program.
Busy man. Well, thank you.
All right. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.